Hi and welcome to another podcast from The Human Diver, where we are looking to apply counter-errorism techniques in diving. By that we mean human factors and non-technical skills. Our goal is to give you the knowledge and skills so that your dives are safer and more enjoyable. The podcast consists of audio blogs which have been published on our website. Show notes will be provided so you can dig deeper if you want. Ready to jump in? The aim of this podcast is to enable the reader to recognize that often when we read accident and incident reports, the cause of outcome is reported as human error. And yet this is such a simplistic and reductionist approach, which adds very little when it comes to improving diving safety. As a consequence, the article will explain that we need to understand the context and sense-making which is present with any adverse event, and determine why it made sense to those involved to make the decisions they made. Fundamentally, divers or instructors do not aim to injure or kill themselves on a dive. If, using hindsight, the risks are perceived to be so obvious, why didn't those involved see them and prevent the accident from happening? The paper will explain some of the theory behind human error, and in the process describing a couple of case studies to show that whilst the simplification to human error is easy, it belies the complexity of the messy and ambiguous real world in which we dive and live. It will then highlight ways in which the diving community can improve their performance and safety. In 2012, an experienced scientific diver was undertaking a training dive to 110 feet with a buddy who had less than 20 rebreather dives after completing her certification. The plan was relatively simple with a low workload, but after nearly 20 minutes at depth, the subject diver had a seizure caused by oxygen toxicity when his breathing loop PO2 was more than 3. The unconscious diver was sent to the surface as the rescuer was losing control of the ascent. Once on the surface, they were recovered by the surface team and given CPR, first aid, and evacuated to a chamber where they made a full recovery. The simplistic reason for this near-death experience was that the diver in question was using a rebreather with cells which were 33 months old, and they had missed the cautions which were displayed by the rebreather on the heads-up display and the handset. However, as will be explained later in the paper, the reality was far more complex than that. Reviewing the literature, it can be seen that diver error is present in research papers and textbooks. Part of the reason the author believes this to be the case is that there is no taxonomy that allows human factors or a deeper understanding of the reasons for the accident to be determined. In Beeren's Drowning, Prevent, Reduce and Treatment, he states, "A thorough investigation usually reveals a critical error in judgment, the diver going beyond his or her level of training and experience, or a violation of generally accepted safe diving practices. In other words, the root cause is most commonly diver error." In De Noble's paper presented at the 2014 Medical Examination of Diving Fatalities conference, he states that fatality investigation is conducted by legal authorities focused on a single case. The main purpose is the attribution of legal responsibility, and this determines how the causation is established. In most cases, the inquiry ends with establishing the proximal cause of death. In aviation, this attitude shifted in the 80s from "the pilot was last to touch it, therefore it was his fault," towards looking at systemic issues, including human factors. In 2008, De Noble, Caruso et al. Published their research, which determined the triggers, disabling agent or action, disabling injury, and cause of death of 947 diving fatalities from the DAN database. Speaking with De Noble in 2016, he stated that this classification process was recognized as being limiting, but a pragmatic approach was needed, and they needed to draw a line somewhere. This is understood. However, there needs to be more work done to understand why 41% of the 947 divers who died in their study did so due to insufficient gas. Most of the time, such a situation is totally preventable, but telling people not to run out won't solve the problem, any more than telling people the paint is wet or the stove is hot. What is human error? One of the problems encountered is that human error can have a number of different meanings. Holnagel describes these as sense number one, error as the cause of failure. this event was due to human error. The assumption is that error is some basic category or type of human behavior that precedes and generates a failure. It leads to variations on the myth that safety is protecting the system and stakeholders from erratic, unreliable people. You can't fix stupid. Sense number two, error as the failure itself, that is the consequences that flow from an event. The choice of dive location was an error. In this sense, the term error simply asserts that the outcome was bad, producing negative consequences, for example, causing injuries to the diver. Sense number three, error as a process, or more precisely, departures from the good process. Here, the sense of error is of deviation from a standard that is a model of what is good practice. But the difficulty is there are different models of what is the process that should be followed. In diving, given the vast variance in standards and skills, what standard is applicable, how standards should be described, and most importantly, what does it mean when deviations from the standards do not result in bad outcomes? Consequently, depending on the model adopted, very different views of error can result. Professor James Reason, in his book Human Error, described the Swiss cheese model as a way of explaining how errors occurred, with the layers in the model being barriers or defenses which are there to prevent the accident from occurring. These layers were entitled organizational influence, unsafe supervision, latent failure, and unsafe acts. Unsafe acts covered both errors and violations and could be considered the last straw which broke the camel's back. Each of these layers described could have holes in them, in effect gaps in the defenses which we put in place to prevent an adverse event. These holes are present because as humans, we are all fallible and we often miss things or don't understand the complex interactions which are possible. In most cases, these mistakes or errors don't matter that much because they are picked up before the situation is critical. However, in some cases, the holes in the cheese line up and an accident happens. There is a need to recognize that this simple 2D static model doesn't replicate the real world in which the holes move and change size. So the ability to detect the failures is much harder, especially given the limitations of the human brain and the biases we are subject to. As many researchers have shown, continual failures at the sharp end often means that there are systemic issues at hand, including physical hardware design. This fact was known in the Second World War when B-17 bomber pilots were continually raising their landing gear instead of raising the flaps whilst taxiing in. Selecting the gear up whilst taxiing would cause the aircraft to crash. No amount of training could resolve the issue across the fleet. However, they invited Fitz, a psychologist, and his team, to see what the pilots were doing, and they noticed that both of the levers to raise the landing gear and the flaps were the same shape and size, and next to each other on the control panel. He suggested that they be spatially separated, and the gear handle have a wheel put on it, so it was obvious it was the gear. The result? No more accidents. Violations, a special sort of error. At the bottom of Reason's model within the unsafe acts section, there are four subsections: slips, lapses, errors, and violations. Violations were defined as the operator, diver, being responsible for actively creating the problem by ignoring or willfully breaking the rules. However, modern safety research has shown that violations are pretty normal and that workers are trying to achieve the best outcome given the pressures they are under, and it would be better to change the system rather than include more rules. Hudson showed that 78% of workers in an offshore environment had broken the rules or wouldn't have a problem breaking them if the opportunity arose, and only 22% had never broken rules and wouldn't do so. Phipps et al. Identified in the anesthetic domain that doctors would break rules, but that it would depend on the rule, how credible it was, who owned, wrote it, what would happen if the rule was broken, punishment, and how clear the rule was. The anesthetist, what their risk perception was like, how experienced and proficient they were, and what the professional group norm was, and the organizational culture or situational factors, how much time pressure they were under, how limited they were in terms of resources, the design of equipment, and how many concurrent tasks were being managed. In terms of diving, there are few formal rules which need to be followed, and much of the adherence is based on risk perception, social or peer pressures to conform, and time or financial pressures. If divers have broken rules and something adverse has happened, it is better to look at why the diver did what they did rather than immediately judge and call them stupid for breaking the rules. There are a couple of biases which divers are all subject to when it comes to incidents and accidents and how they are perceived in terms of causality and contributory factors. These are hindsight bias and outcome bias. In terms of the retrospective view, hindsight bias provides a different perspective to the person involved in the sequence of events. When looking from the outside and with hindsight, an observer has knowledge of the outcome and the dangers involved. However, from the inside, the diver has neither. The diver may also have had limited visibility about what is going on due to focused attention and limited situational awareness. Another take on this is the counterfactual approach to explaining an accident or incident. This is where people go back through a sequence of events and wonder why others missed the opportunities to direct events away from the eventual outcome. Whilst this can explain where the diver went wrong, it does not explain failure. Hindsight bias is something that everyone involved in looking at diving accidents and incidents should be aware of. Not least because, as Anthony Hidden QC, the barrister who led the report examining the Clapham Junction train crash in the UK, where 35 people died and more than 450 people were injured, said, "There is almost no human action or decision that cannot be made to look flawed and less sensible in the misleading light of hindsight. It is essential that the critic should keep himself constantly aware of the fact." Situational awareness. In 1988, Micah Ensley created a model which shows how situational awareness is not just the here and now, as described by her. Situational awareness is the perception of the elements in the environment within a volume of time and space, the comprehension of their meaning, and a projection of their status in the near future. But that individual factors and task or system factors can have an influence as to what is relevant or what can happen to reduce situational awareness. Something to consider is that situational awareness is what it is for the diver. And to say that situational awareness has been lost misses the point that there is a finite resource when it comes to attention, and if something grabs the attention of the diver or is perceived to be more important, then the brain will drop the apparently lesser important activity and focus on the new one. Unfortunately, it is only after the event, when something has gone wrong, that it is possible to determine if the element which was dropped was actually a relevant element or one which should have been monitored more closely. Again, the reduction of an accident or incident to loss of situational awareness is flawed, as it is really just another term for human error. There is a need to understand why the prioritization of elements was perceived to be correct for the activity at hand. Decision making. All models are wrong, but some are useful. Our situational awareness and decision-making processes are influenced by mental models which are created based on experiences. Those experiences can be direct, where the diver has physically encountered the activity or subject, or via learning materials or telling stories. The ease by which it is possible to recall those models is influenced by a number of cognitive biases, as well as the emotional significance attached to the event when it was experienced and encoded in the long-term memory. Of note, those events with higher emotional significance will be recalled more easily, which in itself biases our decision-making process. A point to note is that experts have more models with which to create these subconscious mental simulations, and they can determine which are the more relevant elements, cues, and patterns to look for in a dynamic and ambiguous scene than novices. This is why they make better and faster decisions. In the context of diving, this is why it is essential that skills and experience are developed outside the training environment to expose the diver to the uncertain and ambiguous environment we dive in. The training system cannot teach every situation and every answer. Being a deviant is normal. Over time, the mental models that are created drift from the standards which are taught or should be adhered to. As the performance drifts, new baselines or models as to what is correct are created. In diving, there is a lack of standards about what is right, and in the main, no formal process to reassess performance after a period of time. Consequently, this drift is normally only picked up when something major goes wrong, or divers have safe, scary moments which identify their deviance. This regular and accepted resetting of new baselines is known as normalization of deviance, and came from the investigation by Diane Vaughan into the Challenger shuttle disaster, in which she identified this problem with NASA at an organizational level. The systemic migration to a more risky environment is a natural tendency. Normal operations stitch between safe and unsafe, but as deviations become normal, a new baseline is set. Operations continue here, but at some point something happens and the activity moves over the unacceptable performance boundary, and an accident happens. The difficulty is that it is not possible to determine where that boundary is or what specific combination of factors is needed to combine to cause the adverse event. Brief analysis of the oxygen toxicity event. As a review, the diver in question suffered a seizure due to high partial pressures of oxygen in their breathing loop. The PO2 was more than 3, and the cells in the rebreather were 33 months old. Now to the context. The team who had this event used two sorts of rebreathers. The most prevalent, when serviced, would come back with new oxygen cells fitted. However, the rebreather in question had gone back to its manufacturer in July for a service and did not have its cells replaced with new ones. The reason being that the manufacturer was struggling with the reliability of oxygen cells and customers were complaining about losing dives. As a consequence, the manufacturer decided to return units with customers' cells fitted, but would run a test on them to see if they performed to specification, and provided a service note to the customer about changing the cells. The team received the unit back, noted the cells performed 100%, but missed the piece about replacing them. The unit went on the shelf for 4 months. The day before the dive in question, the unit was dived and performed without an issue. This was the first time it had been dived post-service, and there was likely an assumption made that the cells were in date, as no one had noted the change cells comment from the manufacturer. The checklist they were using at the time did not state to check the cell dates. On the day of the incident, the diver and his buddy entered the water. They descended to approximately 100 feet to carry out their dive. After 9 minutes, there was a caution displayed on the handset, along with a HUD indication. The diver looked down and could not reconcile what the error meant, cell millivolt error, as they had not seen it before. The HUD color indicated a caution and not a warning, so they carried on. After 2 minutes, the HUD color changed back to normal as the system was designed to do. What was happening was that two cells had failed and were now current limited. The rebreather uses a voting logic which is simplified to two cells reading the same take primacy over a single cell, even if the two are incorrect. The system cannot know which is correct. The two cells which had failed at a PO2 of approximately 1.0. This meant that no matter how much oxygen was injected into the loop, the system believed it was below the set point of 1.3 and would keep injecting oxygen into the loop, taking the real PO2 higher and higher. The only indications to the diver that this would be the case would be to check the millivolt readings on the handset, which should happen, but divers are believed not to do this that regularly. At 19 and a half minutes into the dive, the loop PO2 was 3.02, and the third cell was now failing. It is believed that the loop PO2 reached a maximum of 4.1 using extrapolated data. At approximately 26 minutes and 50 seconds, the diver suffered a seizure and was rescued. The rescue and extraction of the divers to the chamber and medical facilities went without a flaw and was commended in the subsequent investigation. Given that the aim of the paper is to look at human error in context, a review of how it made sense for the diver to do what they did, the context and factors will now be revisited. The rebreather had come back from the manufacturer with a clean bill of health, saying the sensors were performing 100% of specification. However, the team missed the comment about changing the cells. Consequently, their mental model was that the cells had been changed based on their experiences of the other manufacturer, which was a more prevalent rebreather in the team. The unit went into the dive locker for 4 months before being used again. The unit was dived the day before and performed as expected. They did not check the cell dates because there was no checklist which asked for this, and the unit had come back from the manufacturer only 4 months prior, both cases of biases which are normal. On the dive in question, the diver had noticed the HUD caution and handset information, but not seen this specific error before during their training. It is not possible to simulate it. And because it was a caution, not a warning, they did not believe it to be that serious, and when it went away, they presumed the fault was transient. The diver was likely relatively task-loaded, having not dived a rebreather for a while, and they were also looking after an inexperienced diver, so didn't check the handset as often as they should have done. Hindsight bias on my part. The HUD didn't give any indication that something was wrong because the voting logic was working as designed. As a result, the diver made an assumption based on previous experiences which informed their mental models that everything was okay when in fact it was heading for a disaster if nothing was done. The key theme to this paper is about learning from events, positive or negative. So what happened with this team to make improvements and learn from failure? Firstly, the manufacturer recognized the human-machine interface issue and escalated this specific caution to a warning in the system and changed the wording on the handset to something more relevant. The manufacturer also ceased sending units back with cells fitted and at the same time found a more reliable supplier. The team went back to basics in terms of how they managed risk and rewrote many of their procedures in the process. They also reinforced their life support and rescue skills, as this was shown to be crucial in not having a fatality during the event. Finally, the team have also undertaken 3 training sessions with me to develop their non-technical human factors skills with a view to becoming a higher performing team, which includes developing a learning and just culture so that the team can talk about mistakes more easily. Summary. A key point to recognize from this podcast is that human error is normal and that accidents and incidents will happen no matter what operators, supervisors, and organizations try to do to mitigate them. Consequently, there is a need to take a different view of safety, something which can be summarized by this quote. Safety is not the absence of accidents or incidents, but rather the presence of defenses and barriers and the ability of the system to fail safely. Todd Conklin. There is an urgent need to change our attitudes if diving safety is to be improved. Blaming people for being stupid is not going to make a difference to safety. In fact, it could be argued that it is having a detrimental effect because failures are not being talked about, and therefore the real risk which is being faced is not known. I believe that the investigation and discussion of fatalities is not the most effective way of improving diving safety, especially when litigation is about pinning the blame on one party or another, and therefore the context and real decision-making is often missing, especially when it comes to violations and rule-breaking. Furthermore, in many cases, the person who knows how it made sense to make the decisions they did is dead. Therefore, there is a need to create the culture within the communities and organizations to be able to recognize human error for what it is and allow those who have made mistakes, errors, and violations to talk about them, free from the fear of social or legal retribution. This is known as a just culture and one of the reasons why aviation is as safe as it is. I will close with a quote from a chapter called Mistaking Error from the Patient Safety Handbook by Woods and Cook, to highlight the complexity of the situation so that when something does go wrong, look deeper than human error. In practice, the study of error is nothing more or less than study of the psychology and sociology of causal attribution. Error is not a fixed category of scientific analysis. It is not an objective, stable state of the world. Instead, it arises from the interaction between the world and the people who create, run, and benefit or suffer from human systems for human purposes. Thanks for listening to this podcast. If you'd like to know more about what was discussed in this episode, head over to the Human Diver website at thehumandiver.com, where you will find details about our education programs, the If Only documentary, the book Under Pressure, and the many, many blogs we have published there. If you think others should listen and learn, consider sharing the link. Thank you.